Welcome to the NACO podcast. Join us as we bring you stories of innovation in counties across the country, cover local government best practices, and provide updates on the issues critical to local government. The National Association of Counties is your resource in fostering healthy, vibrant, safe, and resilient counties across America. Now that we've wrapped up our Cybersecurity Month programming, NACO is happy to present our Cybersecurity Voices of the County podcast. As we approach the age of cyber everything, whether in our smart devices, our homes, our businesses, or our government, life in America's counties is becoming more connected to the internet. NACO continues to be on the forefront of bringing cybersecurity awareness to counties. Today we'll be hearing three different stories about cybersecurity. The experts that join us will be sharing their experiences and opinions around cybersecurity in their counties. We begin today with Maricopa County, Arizona, with a cyber incident that caused some disruption to the election process there.
My name is Helen Purcell, and I am the Maricopa County Recorder. Election day, our voters are allowed, if they've gotten an early ballot, which is in the mail, and they haven't sent that back to us yet, they are allowed to drop those ballots off at any polling place. And in the 2012 election, they dropped off 171,500 of those early ballots. Then in addition to that, if a person has to vote a provisional ballot, they do that at the polling place. And in that election, 122,500 voted provisionals. So this made us close to 300,000 ballots that we still had to process and count if they could be counted. There were a couple of very close races going on, and we had several groups that were apparently dissatisfied with the speed in which we were going to handle these ballots that were left over after Election Day. On the day after the election, we had noticed some emails coming into my email account. It turned out to be tens of thousands of emails that were being sent to us, preventing a normal conduct of our business. And it was not an attempt to have a plea heard by myself or anybody in my office, but really a concerted effort just to clog up our system.
What Helen is describing is a common internet attack called a denial of service attack. These work by overwhelming computer systems with nonsensical or irrelevant requests, for the sole purpose of tying up its resources and preventing it from doing the work for which it was intended. Okay, so let's slow down here. Essentially, the attack is sending a bunch of requests for the sole purpose of slowing down the system and stopping it from doing its job. This email barrage on their system was an attempt to do this.
So when we identified this, we immediately had to go into a kind of mode of what we do to correct this. Because this could have very easily not only brought our complete email system down, but also the county. And as you may or may not know, Maricopa County is the fourth largest county in the country. And that something like this would take place would certainly not allow us to do business. There again, as I said, I record all of these real estate documents too. We do probably over $1 billion worth of commerce every day. So we knew that we had to put something in place and concentrate maybe a little bit more than what we had in the past.
We've seen the dangers that modern technology poses. The question is then, whether county elections are ready for electronic voting?
We have some of that already in the state of Arizona and several other states around the country. Some of our military and overseas voters are allowed to vote over the internet through a secure portal is the way we bring them into Arizona. And then they send that ballot to us by email. You basically know how somebody has voted because you've got their email there with their name on it. And now you are duplicating that ballot. With our military and overseas, they have said that's not important to them. what's important to them that they are able to vote and otherwise they would not be able to. So I think for security purposes, we are not at the level yet in order to have everyone vote electronically. I don't think we're there yet because I don't think we have the security in place. But that's not to say that we won't in the very near future.
For Maricopa County after 2012, a major issue was regaining public trust.
That was the thing that was my biggest concern, because elections are really perception. And there was a perception because of these groups that stormed our office. We had hundreds of people in our offices banging on the doors and trying to get into conference rooms and so forth. And you have to give your constituents, your public out there, the comfort feeling that their election is being handled in such a way that they have trust in that system. So that's what we had to build through that process of going through this. So we tried to keep a constant rapport going with the press so they could advise the people that here's the job we were doing. In addition to that, we have added some things since that election that would help the public understand what we are doing in that period of time. Because my people work from 7 in the morning until 10 at night when we're trying to finish up an election. So we put cameras inside our facility that would allow the public to see what we were doing. They know we're processing these ballots and see what we're doing. And also they can see in our tabulation room as we're tabulating the ballots. So I think that gives a trust to our voters.
Helen is the chair of the NACO Information Technology Committee and sits on the Cybersecurity Task Force. As an elected official, this puts her in a unique position of someone who understands the election process, its associated technology, and general cybersecurity. Considering this, she has some critical lessons learned for other counties.
Well, I think we all have to be aware of issues that can come up during election, particularly when you might have an election that is really very cantankerous. So we all need to be aware of that ahead of time and, as much as possible, have backups that you can go to. As I did, I was absolutely amazed at the security that suddenly came to my aid in both the technology field and the physical field that would allow us to continue doing what we were doing until we were finished with that process. Counties have to understand that there may have to be things, an investment in infrastructure that they put in place in order for them to have that perception to their public to know that these elections are safe and secure.
For part two of our Cybersecurity Month podcast, we'll be discussing cyberbullying. Albany County, New York, recently enacted some groundbreaking cyberbullying laws. Phil Bertolini, NACO's vice chair of the Information Technology Committee and the IT Workforce Working Group, sat down with Brian Clenahan, who's with the Albany County Legislature.
Hello, my name is Phil Bertolini, and I'm the Deputy County Executive and Chief Information Officer here in Oakland County, Michigan. I'm pleased to be here with you today to talk to Brian Clenahan, who is with the Albany County Legislature, and he's going to talk a bit about cyberbullying. So, Brian, you know, I know that cyberbullying is a big issue in our schools today. It's really a big issue just out on the internet today. Can you tell us a little bit why cyberbullying legislation might be important?
The problem of cyberbullying is exploding. The U.S. Department of Justice recently had a study suggesting that up to a third of all teens are subjected to cyberbullying in their lifetime. The U.S. Department of Health had another study that found that maybe up to 15% of all students have been cyberbullied. So it's clearly a pervasive problem. Healthcare professionals have concluded that victims of cyberbullying can suffer from all manner of ailments, social difficulties, anxiety, depression, and sometimes even suicidal ideation. And the worst tragedy of this issue is that many victims of cyberbullying have gone on to complete suicide. And of course, technology is so quickly expanding and inadvertently expanding the ability to cyberbully at the same time. So, you know, we have an absolute duty to address this and try to prevent it as best we can. And we've addressed physical bullying comprehensively in criminal law for many years. It really is essential that we move forward with comprehensive cyberbullying in the same way we did to fight physical bullying.
So, Brian, you know, I'm a father of teen boys myself, and I've seen some of the communications that go on between, you know, boys and boys and girls today, and it's pretty serious stuff. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the content that, you know, that might be at issue here in regard to cyberbullying legislation?
I think, you know, looking at some of the content that has been prosecuted already in Albany County on our prior law, and I'll get to that a little bit later, but what we're talking about is it's teenagers using the web, using the anonymity of the web, to launch all manner of misogynistic, racist, homophobic attacks, often sexually derogatory comments, often fabricated sexual stories, sometimes even posting of sexual images. So it's a wide range of discriminatory and frankly hateful conduct that kind of falls under the banner of cyberbullying. The cyberbullying local law that we passed a few months ago in Albany County was actually the second bill we passed. The first was back in 2010. And one of the first prosecutions under that 2010 law happened in 2011, about a year later. It involved a 15-year-old high school student who had created a web page with all manner of personal racist, sexist, misogynist attacks, stories, lies, some images, really all manner of offensive and frankly harmful conduct. He pled guilty to the charge, but challenged the constitutionality of the law in coordination with the New York Civil Liberties Union. A county court upheld the law, but the Court of Appeals, in a split decision, struck down our old cyberbullying law last summer. After that, the legislature moved pretty quickly to review the Court of Appeals decision and draft a new proposed law based on that decision. So that went on over the course of the summer and early fall this year. So after a committee review process, after a public hearing, back in September, the legislature passed the new cyberbullying law. It became effective in October.
So, Brian, which issues, you know, that were found, you know, unconstitutional in the original law, how did you solve those in the new piece of legislation?
Well, the Court of Appeals majority ruled that the original law was too broad and violated the First Amendment Freedom of Speech Clause. The concern seemed to be that the prohibition could apply to anyone and to any electronic form of communication, and that it could apply to types of communication beyond cyberbullying. You know, the good thing with the Court of Appeals decision, the majority decision, was that it actually gave us a pretty clear roadmap in terms of how to draft a constitutionally permissible cyberbullying law. So accordingly, when we drafted the new law over the summer, we limited potential victims to those under the age of 18. We also more sharply defined electronic communication or the specific use of online services like blogs, bulletin boards, social media, or chat rooms. We also tighten the language quite a bit to state that a charge can be brought only when someone maliciously engages in a course of conduct by electronically transmitting information not of public concern with the intent to inflict emotional harm on a minor.
And I know that no matter how hard you work or how much you do, there's always going to be someone in opposition. Did the opposition, you know, did it get formalized? Was there a large group in opposition to the new law?
So of note, there was very little opposition from other legislators. I don't remember the exact vote, but I think we have a fairly large legislature here. It's 39 members, but if I remember correctly, maybe four or five voted against the 2010 bill, and maybe three voted against our 2014 bill. So not much opposition from the legislators, and there was really bipartisan Republicans and Democrats in support across the aisle. We did face some opposition from the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Alliance for Quality Education.
And when they opposed the bill, were they able to rally any kind of public support?
I would say the public support was pretty limited. We heard some comments from basically a couple of leaders of those groups at our public hearing back in August, but in terms of public support, frankly, it was the other way. You know, we heard more from law enforcement, we heard from prosecutors, and we heard from victims and victims' advocates about the need for this law and the need to get it going quickly as possible. The other part of their position was they seemed to think that fighting cyberbullying should be done just by education and community outreach, which are important things and certainly important components of fighting this, but not the only one, and I would argue not the most effective one. You know, cyberbullies may need more than just recriminations from a teacher or a principal. So we're not really looking at a situation where teenagers being prosecuted and sent to jail. anyone who's accused under this would more likely end up in the family court system under the juvenile delinquency system, where, you know, it is an adversarial proceeding. There are criminal consequences and the possibility of consequences, but those courts take a much greater role to try to really mediate to some degree and really look out for the interest not just of the victim but also the defendant, in light of the fact that they are underage and they are minors.
Okay, quick note here. According to Brian, one of the concerns raised about the law by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Alliance for Quality Education was whether this law would be turning children into criminals.
The other part of their position was they seem to think that fighting cyberbullying should be done just by education and community outreach, which are important things and certainly important components of fighting this, but not the only one, and I would argue not the most effective one. You know, cyberbullies may need more than just recriminations from a teacher or a principal. So we're not really looking at a situation where teenagers being prosecuted and sent to jail. Anyone who's accused under this would more likely end up in the family court system under the juvenile delinquency system, where, you know, it is an adversarial proceeding. There are criminal consequences and the possibility of consequences, but those courts take a much greater role to try to really mediate to some degree and really look out for the interest not just of the victim but also of the defendant, in light of the fact that they are underage and they are minors.
And, you know, based on all the work that you've done with the legislature and the work that you've done in regard to this topic of cyberbullying, do you have any advice for people out there that may be looking out for their children, or advice for those that are minors to keep an eye and understand and really know what's happening when it's happening?
Well, I think we are going to have to be vigilant in terms of supervising our kids and the use of online media, the internet. Technology is exploding quicker than we can control it, but I think it will require a lot of vigilance. But I would encourage other local governments to really pursue statutes like this. It really gives our schools, gives our parents, an extra tool in fighting cyberbullying. I think it can be very effective and can really give a hand up in fighting these things. These are difficult fights. Technology changes quickly. The ability to get these kind of hateful messages out grows all the time. I really think that legislation like this is going to be necessary across the country, and I think it will really give parents an extra edge in keeping up on these issues and protecting the kids.
For our final segment, Phil sat down with Steve Hurst, Director of Security Services at AT&T.
Cybersecurity risks are really wide and varied. Typically, what we see is that counties spend money on traditional firewall controls and intrusion detection controls to limit where people can go. But counties, like many other organizations, don't look at the risks involved and look at really where the weak points are, where the higher vulnerability points are. So what counties can really do is focus on two things outside of what they're most likely already doing. One is to focus on the value of the data. What is being protected and what is critical or would have the largest impact if it was stolen? Voter information, citizen resident information, tax information, information that's not or should not be widely published needs to be protected. Personal information needs to be protected. The other piece is really to look at where the vulnerabilities are and how information gets out. And the number one vulnerability there is people. So it's really critical to include in the program to protect the county's information is the ongoing education of the county employees as well as any volunteers who may also be accessing those systems.
So Steve, you know, I'm in a larger county here in Oakland County, Michigan. We have 1.2 million residents and we have a medium-sized IT staff. But there's many governments that just don't have the IT staff on board that has cybersecurity experience. Knowing that one of the most difficult aspects of their job is to know exactly what their issues are,
mm-hmm.
What are the biggest vulnerabilities that counties should be looking at or looking for when they're assessing what they have?
Well, when assessing what they have, it's important to look at how the environment has been crafted and how the installed base has been put into place. One of the things that's very really critical and can significantly reduce the risks is to harden machines when they get installed. And what hardening is turning off all the parts of the machine or parts of the software that you don't need or you're not going to use when you install the device. This way, if there are communication channels that aren't necessary, they're turned off and essentially blocked. By doing that, you're reducing the profile of the environment of the county's network to someone who's trying to get in and get information out of the county. Another piece that really becomes critical is making sure that those machines stay updated. Antivirus software to make sure that you're watching for worms and viruses, putting patches in place to make sure that any vulnerabilities that are discovered are taken care of based on the patches that are provided by the vendors.
I've looked at data in a number of different places, and it all comes back to the people that are interacting with the technology. And I think the last piece of data that I had seen was that 95% of all issues, whether it be malware or whatever it may be, that 95% of those are directly related to a person's actions. So if you were to recommend the type of training for county employees, what would you recommend?
Well, what I really recommend is taking a multi-phased approach. I would start with a program that's available through some government associations. Program's called Stop, Think, Connect. With Stop, Think, Connect, it's a way to teach people how to take a pause before doing things and to think what the end result is going to be. Coming from that organization, and there is information available through both DHS, Stay Safe Online, and the Cybersecurity Alliance that can be downloaded. In fact, a lot of it has been available the last 2 years at the NACO Cybersecurity Conference. But it's doing simple things. It's keeping the software current on a machine, software updates, especially Microsoft updates, Adobe updates can be automated, watching for personal information, being careful what you're connecting to. A lot of advanced persistent threats come in through social engineering. And social engineering is when someone convinces you to do something that looks to be correct but may not be.
So many IT shops in government today are providing services and applications so that the business units can do their job, which is servicing the people. But if you restrict the technology so much, you may be taking the power of the technology out of the hands of the government worker. How does a government balance that risk? How do they manage it?
Balancing the risks for government workers is a full circle, because you have to look at what is required to be shared by the municipality, by the state, by the federal government, with the harm that would occur if that information is disclosed. You have to share police reports, but you don't share details about ambulance calls. You may have to share real estate information, but you don't have to share social security numbers and a lot of the information that goes into a tax return. The same way you don't want to share it, you don't want to take it out of a controlled environment. So it's teaching the employees, don't put this type of data on a smart drive and take it and work on it at home, because that becomes a risk to the county and a risk to the citizens of the county. The way I like to look at it is to thinking of information and thinking of a defense in depth approach. Defense in depth is when you put multiple layers of security around something. It could be gates, lights, and guards around a building, or it could be a firewall, intrusion detection, encryption around computer data. But when you think of these multiple layers of security, you can also think about different controls and different ways you limit the access to that information. Identifying the data first, and then checking to see if you have controls around the data based on its value to the county or its value as personal identifiable information or personal health identifiable information, gives you the idea of the types of controls that need to be put into place or the numbers of controls that need to be put into place.
Well, Steve, we've appreciated all the advice you've given us today. Do you have any last bits of advice for the listeners to our podcast?
One is to be aware of what data the county has and what its value is to the county. Second, make use of resources that are available, make use of tools from other counties, make use of expertise from other counties, make use of expertise that's within the county. Third, take the education of the county employees and the mindset of the county employees, not just while they're at work, but when they come home as well. And the Stop, Think, Connect program is a good way to do that. And by following those three basic precepts, they should be able to significantly lower their cyber risks.
Cybersecurity is critical in all things counties do.
Cybersecurity is everyone's responsibility. And just because you don't know doesn't give you a reason not to take care of business, because it's not if it'll happen, it's when it'll happen.
We'd like to thank Helen Purcell, Phil Bertolini, Brian Clanahan, and Steve Hurst for joining us. As always, be sure to check back for new episodes at www.nacopodcast.org.